We all know your mind can sometimes get the better of you. So when you're in that position, how do you then tame your mind monster? This is something today's podcast guest, Hazel Gale, knows all about. Hazel is a cognitive hypnotherapist and is the author of the book, The Mind Monster Solution: How to Overcome Self-Sabotage and Reclaim Your Life. Self-sabotage through mental health is something Hazel knows all too well during her kickboxing and boxing career. Others may have seen an accomplished championship-winning athlete, but the reality was much different. Instead, she was plagued by self-doubt, anxiety, and depression. That's your mind's monsters. That all came to a head through her overtraining in her sport, as she constantly felt she had to do more and more and more. The result? Chronic fatigue, constant injuries, and high stress. But at her lowest, Hazel discovered the form of therapy that she now practices in, and it's essentially changed her life. She went on to win international and national titles in her sports, and now uses her platform to help others try and control their own mind monsters. From the highs to the very lows, this is Hazel Gale's story. Hazel, thanks so much for coming onto the podcast and being our latest feature interview guest on the show. First off, I suppose I should ask you how lockdown is treating you, considering we're doing these interviews in very strange circumstances right now.
Yeah, I've spent a hell of a lot of time in this room. Lockdown is pretty tough. I'm really, really busy. So I'm not bored. I'm not having that problem with lockdown. I'm just struggling with, breaking up my days and not everything feeling like work.
Exactly. And trying to work out what day is which as well. I find they're all blurring into one at the moment.
When I've given up on that.
Yeah. I mean, calendars are a thing of the past in my
world. Yeah.
We've obviously got a lot of stuff to talk about on this podcast, and I think quite a lot of it is probably relevant to people right now with various challenges that lockdown and the current pandemic presents for people at home, regardless of whether you're in sport or not. So I kind of want to work towards the idea of cognitive hypnotherapy as well, which is what you're trained in and practicing in. But kind of first want to talk about the mind monster. For people who don't know, the title of your book is The Mind Monster Solution, which we'll pick apart a little bit later in more detail. But first off, can you just describe to people who aren't particularly familiar with the concept what the mind monster is ultimately?
Yeah, so I wanted to write a book that was about how we self-sabotage. So we all do that in a number of really different ways. Of course, some people do it with their behaviors and they binge eat or drink too much or procrastinate or whatever. But we can also do it with our emotions. And sometimes it can feel like we're sabotaging ourselves when we get too nervous. You know, you hear that a lot in sports, people sort of hating their own emotions because they get in the way of a good performance. And we can obviously do it with our thoughts too, you know, reading ideas into situations that are totally made up, ruminating over issues, not being able to sleep at night because we're catastrophizing about what might happen tomorrow. So we self-sabotage in this vast number of different ways. And so I didn't want to have to write 300 books on all of the different individual versions of self-sabotage. And also I don't think it's a useful thing to try and pigeonhole ourselves into, oh, I'm an anxiety sufferer or I'm a binge eater. It doesn't really achieve anything. So the mind monster is essentially a label-free metaphor for any kind of issue that we struggle with in mental health. So I get to sidestep the diagnosis issue, which I'm not going to go into loads of detail about it, but it is potentially really disempowering to just stick to our labels. And also get to talk about these things in a much more holistic way, because the other thing about it, of course, is that rarely will people think, I just have one problem. Like, I just do procrastination and I never struggle with any of the rest of it. That's unlikely. Most of us would be more likely to say, okay, I've got a bit of an anxiety issue here and I procrastinate over there. Oh, and I comfort eat too, because they all play into one another. So the mind monster concept is a way of getting to talk about everything without having to go into sort of details of labeling at all.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean then, if it's sort of a, I don't want to call it a catch-all term, but I think you kind of know what I mean by that. And there's a lot of...
That's fine. And what it describes... I mean, that's an important thing that I haven't mentioned there is it comes from parts therapy, which is a tried and tested, decades-old version of therapy where you look at the part of the personality that whatever. So if you're thinking about anxiety, the mind monster will be the part of the personality that gets anxious. If you're thinking about binge eating, it's the part that craves food and takes you to the fridge and eats a whole chocolate cake when really you don't want to be eating it. So this idea of parts therapy means that it's brilliant because you get to the best way to work with that kind of issue is to create some kind of visual, basically personify the part of the personality so that you can start to understand its motives and its values and its feelings and actually eventually have a communication with it to change the strategies it's using. That's the whole point of the book, is to get people in touch with that part so they can stop just thinking of it as a monster and instead see it as something that they can value and use.
So in terms of the mind monster, what was it communicating to you? And then it goes back on itself, what made you able to communicate back in turn with it?
So what was my monster about? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Yeah. So my main issue, so the thing about monsters, when you get in touch with them, you really start to look at what they're actually saying. There's a whole different sort of layer, sort of multi-layered thing going on with them. At the surface you have like the immediate thoughts and the immediate behaviors, but if you dive down through that stuff, what you get to is far deeper, really human stuff that we all struggle with. The fear of not being good enough, the fear of you don't be a human being with empathy without experiencing that stuff. So this is, so when you say, well, I'm saying that's fine, because it's basically just what it is to be human. It's the dark side of being human. And so my monster was all about telling me I wasn't good enough. In particular for me, it was about telling me I was weak. I was petrified of looking weak. And as a boxer, you know, I was putting myself in positions where I could look weak pretty often. And also I think that's probably why I chose boxing. It was the ultimate way for me to prove to myself and the rest of the world that I was no weakling, you know? And because of that sort of not so healthy way of getting into the sport, eventually boxing broke me.
So that's quite interesting then, in that it was... This strength side of thing is what essentially put you into that sport in the first place. But did it almost become like your identity, really, and just all consume you? And that you felt you were this strong person and wanted to be seen to be as strong as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it became like this mask sort of facade. The thing is with all these issues, like any monster is both a strength and a weakness. In many ways, it's... becomes a weakness when you overuse the strength. So I had a real genuine strength of being strong, both in terms of, you know, mentally strong in that I would persevere, you know, I'd put up with failures and keep working hard to move towards a goal. And I was physically strong. I was always strong at school. I was arm wrestling and beating all the boys. I even beat a bunch of sailors at arm wrestles once in a Thai bar, but we don't need to talk about that now.
That's a backstory itself, isn't it?
That's book number two. So I was, you know, I was genuinely strong, but because I then got too sort of connected, associated with that strength, and because it became my personality, it turned into like either I'm strong or I'm a complete failure. So any moment where I had a loss, either like a big loss like in the ring or a small loss like losing at a press-up competition in the gym, it felt like a kind of death to me because I was so connected to this mask that I was wearing of this strong person. So it became a real flaw.
It's really become like an either or situation. If I kind of look for, say, a running equivalent, for example, and you manage to hit 5k one day, and then you only do 2.5k the next day, and you see that as a failure, and that it sounds like that's kind of what ruled your life for quite a period.
Oh yeah, and but everyone's doing that in their own ways. Like we all get, this is what that dark side of being human does to us. It turns everything into this binary experience. Either I win or I am a failure. Like either I'm the thinnest person in the room or I'm fat and unattractive, you know, whatever. That with everyone, either I'm the most muscly person in the room or I'm a weakling, as if there's only ever two options, like, which is, of course, totally untrue, but we're all doing this all the time.
And I suppose that's one of the key lines I picked out from your website when I was going through it before, is the doubting voice. That's how you described it. And basically how impactful that can be on your life, having that nagging doubt going round and round your head, which I think is something everyone can probably relate to in one way or another. So I mean, off the back of that, how do you end up taming that, and as you say, turning that weakness into your strength?
Yeah, so I'm gonna make this a simple process here. I think that might be optimistic, but in theory it's simple. That doesn't mean it's easy in practice. But the thing is that there is no, we have our monsters, we have our problems, and we have that doubting voice, and we think of it as bad and we just need to get rid of it. So you got somebody in therapy and they say, "No, I've got this problem, I'm smoking cigarettes and I don't want to." And then you ask them about the part that wants to smoke cigarettes and what they want to do with it, they'll just say they want to kill it or throw it in the bin or, you know, leave it somewhere and go elsewhere. Because we want to just delete these parts. But that's the problem. The more we fight against them, the harder they have to fight back to be heard. So if we battle with doubt, we're just going to end up doubting ourselves even more. We battle with anxiety, we make ourselves more anxious. We battle with something like comfort eating, we will end up eating more because the stress of battling with it makes us want comfort even more, and then we turn to food and then we get even more stressed. So it always becomes this self-fulfilling cycle where things get worse and worse. And the flip side of all of this is that there is no evil part of the personality. There is no part of you or me or anyone else that actually wants to derail us. There's the reason we have these parts of the personality doing these things that we can see as negative is because there's a miscommunication somewhere. They think that the behavior is going to help. A comfort eating monster thinks that the chocolate cake is going to make the person feel better. A smoking monster thinks the cigarette's going to make the person feel better. The intention behind our self-sabotaging behaviors is always good and always protective. Like, it's sort of like a coping mechanism that fires up to say, "Look, this is stressful, this is scary. If we just do this, then we'll feel better." Which is why fighting it doesn't work. You can't fight a part of the personality and win. You can't fight yourself and then, you know, walk away victorious. It doesn't work like that. So instead, we need to get to know that part so we can empathize with it, empathize with the self. And then by striking up a communication with it, we can change the strategies. This is where the doubting voice comes in. You know, what if you can hear that doubting voice and instead of just closing your eyes and hoping it goes away, you can kind of talk to yourself about it, talk through the problem. Like, okay, so you think we're not going to be able to do this, but what if we could? What about that other time when we did it before? There's a way of communicating with the self that starts to just pull the rug out from under the feet of the fear that the monster is based on. And once you get into that place, you can change pretty much anything.
To throw it back to, I suppose, your own personal example on that, as and the self-sabotage, I suppose, kind of manifested itself in the chronic fatigue that you've talked about before, and it's on your website. And I mean, it must have been a horrible thing to go through. This is sort of a two-part question, really. Is first off, when did you realize just how much damage you were doing to yourself? But then, based on what you've just said, how does recognizing what that self-doubting voice is telling you flip it on its head and arguably make you better than you were before?
It did make me better than I was before. So in kind of metaphorical terms, the way I see it is that when I was still resisting all of this and I wasn't working from that acceptance point of view, and I didn't have the awareness, every time I got in the ring, I wasn't just fighting my opponent, I was fighting my opponent and the monster, the fear of failure, the fear of weakness. And it meant that even if I did win, I would feel like I'd lost. Once I'd moved to the place where I could accept that part and understand it, and understand where this overemphasis on strength had come from, that had come from my dad, who was a very sporty man and praised me for being strong when I was younger. So clearly, you know, I developed a belief that it was a good thing to be strong. I'd just taken it too far. Once I'd done that work, I felt like I was going into the ring and my monster was on my team instead of something I had to battle. So I was only up against one opponent after that. And the fighting experience was completely different for me then. And I had the fight I always talk about, the real turning point for me, it was 2013, and I was fighting in the national championships, ABA Boxing National Championships. And I'd been doing the therapy work for some time up to this point, but this was where I really, really felt that it was different. Just right from the warm-up, I felt present in the warm-up room. And I was skipping and I was watching everybody, and I felt just okay. And I realized when I stepped out into the audience, to walk through the audience to the ring, and it felt peaceful in there. It was really weird. This really strange feeling that it felt like the crowd had been sort of hushed by a crisp layer of freshly fallen snow. And instead of battling with my doubt and feeling like I wanted to run away and do something else, I just had this little voice in my head that says, I've got this, like I can do this. Not a sort of overly arrogant, I'm going to win, I'm king of the world kind of belief. That doesn't help either. That's just monster in disguise. But what this was just a realistic thing. Just like, I deserve this win. Like if I don't win, that's okay. If I do win, that's okay too, because I deserve to be here. And that was a totally different experience. So the fight went well. There were real moments of flow in that fight where I just felt like my body, you know, when you're in the flow state, it's almost like you can sit back and watch yourself doing things well. And you kind of, I remember throwing a straight right to the body. She was a southpaw and she ducked into it and just basically ducked straight into my punch. And I remember thinking, oh, that was cool. And then a couple of moments later, I did it again and the same thing happened. I was like, where is this even coming from? I didn't even plan that. It just happened. So I won the fight, but there was this moment at the end of it where my hand was raised and I felt this surge of completely alien emotion. I'm still not sure if it was just like happiness or pride or a sense of achievement or what, but it was completely new. And I realized at that point that I could look back on all the other victories I'd had, which had included things like European and world titles in kickboxing. And every time my hand had been raised, I'd never once allowed myself to feel a sense of victory. Instead, I just felt shame, like shame for being in the, for like, I don't deserve this. Or there must be some mistake. Or I'd write it off like, I've just won this, but my opponent probably wasn't very good. I'd always felt ashamed of winning. On this day, I could just own the triumph for the very first time. And yeah, like I say, turning point, like things have been building up for years before that. But when I had that experience in the ring, basically it's the first time I'd ever felt anything properly in the ring other than a vague sense of relief that I hadn't lost. And then I knew that everything was different. And the kind of irony here is that's the point when I decided I didn't need to box anymore. It wasn't like then I was like, then my career started. Actually, I was like, you know what? I don't need to do this to prove myself. I've been doing it for 10 years and I've got other things I want to do. Because by that point, I was training to become a therapist. No, by that point, I already was a therapist. I wanted to dedicate my time to that and writing books and doing all the other stuff that I'm doing now. And it was the right decision.
Was that almost like sort of you'd closed the chapter? Really on that part of your life, and it was time to move on to second chapter.
It was, and it wasn't that I had to stop boxing. I still trained after that, and I still coach now, but I just didn't need to do it in that capacity anymore. Anyway, after 10 years, I mean, I don't tend to last more than 10 years in any area because I like things to be new and exciting, and even though that particular fight was a new experience for me, I was ready for a change, and I'd got in touch with different values. And I often think back on this, I wasn't aware of this at the time, but I realise now what I did at that point was swapped a world where hurting somebody else is basically the objective, even though of course it's not vicious or malicious, it's just the sport, but that is essentially what I was doing. I swapped that to move into a world where I was trying to help people heal and get better and feel stronger. And it just seemed to make so much more sense to me after doing that work.
To throw that on then, and you say you got into boxing basically to prove that you were strong and that you were stronger than everyone else. Why did you get into therapy?
I got into therapy because the therapy that I'd had that moved me from that broken, burnt out, anxious state of self-loathing into the world in which I had met my monster, could invite it into the ring with me and could feel deserving of success. That transition happened because of therapy. And I felt just completely compelled to learn more about it first, and then compelled to help others in the same way that I've been helped. And also, it was really creative. So I was always very creative as a kid. I went to art school. You know, as a child, I was constantly creating random things. And then I let go of that a bit when I got to boxing. I sort of pushed that away and decided to be this uber sort of sporty and quite masculine kind of version of myself. And therapy allowed me to get back into it, because especially my style of therapy is a lot to do with creativity and creative imagery, visualizations, metaphors, things like that, which are just, they really make me feel happy to work with people in that way. So yeah, it kind of felt like a homecoming, really, to come back to all of that after this sort of deviation into the sports world.
And I totally get what you mean with the homecoming side of things. One thing, and feel free to disagree with me on this, but it kind of, in terms of visualization, to me, it sounds like you almost split yourself into two people, in that there's this creative side of you, but then there's the strong boxing side of you as well. And it's almost like the therapy side brought both of those back together, whereas before they were maybe two separate things, if that's fair to say.
It's an excellent description, because that's basically what parts therapy is all about. We use the word split. We talk, when a part has become problematic, we say that it's split off. And the process of working in that way, the goal is to reintegrate it. So this merging of all of the different versions of the self back into something which is a cohesive whole, that's the goal. And it's a lifelong work. Like, nobody ever gets to 100% integrated, really. There's always something popping up. But yeah, that moment for me was when that strong part, that sort of surface level strong self part, was invited back. Along with the fearing part that had been totally shut out, because how could I possibly have fear if I was super strong? That was the big conflict while I was boxing. But I allowed all of that to come back in, and of course all of those parts play a part in therapy.
Was there almost a part of you then that almost shunned the strong part of you, or the strong part of your personality? And with what you were talking about before, that constant sense of failure and that you weren't worth it or up to it, even when you won boxing matches, and almost that reluctance to accept that part of you was maybe part of the problem all along.
Yeah, it was like there were these two bickering characters inside me. One of them that felt like it was super strong and would not accept weakness, and one of them that felt that it was super weak and couldn't possibly tolerate strength. And because of this binary world again that we put ourselves in, I was just seesawing back and forth between these extremes. So the one minute feeling like queen of the world, and the next minute feeling like a pathetic loser. And there was just no point of marriage. There was no, like, the real me, which is somewhere in between those two extremes, had been lost in this fight. And instead I'd ended up just back and forth between this black and white, you know, neither of them comfortable situation.
Hello listeners, we're here to take a quick break to mention something very important. Max Hunter was a huge supporter of the Mintridge Foundation, our charity partner, and was a huge believer in sport as a tool for positive change. He died by suicide in August 2019, aged 28. Of course, we know the potential sport has to boost your mental health and how important it is to open up and have an honest conversation if you ever need to, but it is never that straightforward. That's why the Mintridge Foundation have created the Max Hunter Fund to encourage everyone to acknowledge their feelings on a regular basis. This also coincides with a very special event, the 28 Not Out panel, which is on July the 10th. We will be hosting a live panel all about mental health and sport, featuring England rugby international Dan Cole. The panel, which we will be streaming over Zoom, will also feature psychotherapist and counsellor Gemma Saggers, Liam Durkin from the Papyrus Prevention of Young Suicide charity, and also Dan Griffin from Stanford Rugby Club, who was a great friend of Max. As part of 28 Not Out, there will also be 28 hours of non-stop fundraising that weekend. Tickets for the Mental Health Live panel are just £2.80, and details are available on Eventbrite. You can find the link on our social platforms and also in the show notes of this podcast episode. So please join us over Zoom for this very important, very special day, all in memory of Max Hunter. Thank you.
You're listening to Sportspiel, the Players Podcast.
So in terms of the cognitive therapy side of things, first off, for those who don't fully appreciate what it involves, because I think we all know there's various kinds of therapies out there, but first off, what is it, and what is it about it that you found so particularly helpful?
So what is it is, so the title of my therapy is cognitive hypnotherapy, but that's extremely misleading because the hypno part, I mean, most sessions wouldn't even include something that people would expect with that name. And even when we do some sort of eyes closed suggestion bits, it's like the last 10 minutes of a 90 minute session. So the bulk of the work, it's probably something similar to what you'd expect with psychotherapy or counselling, in that it's a talk therapy. And the way I see it is it's two people coming together on a level. It's not expert and patient. That's not the deal. It's two people coming together, more of a coaching kind of situation, to say, here's a problem. How can we fix it? But not just how can we fix it in terms of practicalities, but how can we get your unconscious mind to come on board with this? Because most people who have a comfort eating issue know with their conscious mind that they shouldn't be comfort eating. Like, it's not a logic problem. It's the fact that even though they know that, they're still doing it. So I see my job as a way of striking up the right kind of conversation to connect that logical part up with the feeling, reacting part of the self, which is really the unconscious self. And that brings me to what I love about it the most, is that that means you get to work in this creative way, because the unconscious mind doesn't respond to logic and reasoning in the way the conscious mind does, which is why we can't, you know, it's why it's so hard to talk ourselves out of a cigarette or a glass of wine or the chocolate cake or whatever else we do, or training when we're too tired, which was my main problem. We can't talk ourselves out of it because we just can't logic your way out of an emotional problem. And so to connect up between the to actually speak to that unconscious part, you need to get involved in story and metaphor and imagery. And every client is a completely different situation. There's no like stock metaphor that you can use for everybody with an anxiety issue, because it would make sense to like 1% of the people you tried it on. So the fun for me is asking people and finding out what the metaphors are that they need to use and how they need to see it and how they want to see it. So that all happens in the bulk of the session. And at the end of it, we wrap it up with some guided visualization stuff that they get to take away on a recording, which is why it's cognitive hypnotherapy rather than just cognitive therapy.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose in terms of the benefits for yourself, there's obviously a lot out there, but now that you are getting to be in a position where you can give this guidance to people, it must help you, or at least feel so rewarding that you can see the changes that you saw in yourself almost reflected back at you through your client.
I mean, it's funny. I mean, definitely, like, anyone who goes into therapy hoping it's going to help them is obviously on a bit of a rocky road. But anybody who is in therapy, you know, it's undeniable that it does help. I've been doing this now. I've been practicing now for almost 10 years. And I have changed, you know, I'd done all of my own therapy work before the practice, of course, enough to get to a pretty good place. But I've changed so much more in that time, because just hearing people's stories is therapeutic, no matter what happens. And learning to empathize with people and learning to understand people. You can't learn to understand people without learning to understand yourself better. So I mean, there's probably nothing really more rewarding than working in this way. Obviously, sometimes it's also really, really challenging and difficult. But when sessions are going well and you have a good rapport with your clients, it feels like the best job in the world.
In the 10 years you've been practicing then, how do you think you've changed? What do you think has been the biggest change, and maybe even the biggest learning that you've had in that time?
I think that the biggest learning is that, and I think I probably had an idea about this before, but I wasn't able to say it with such certainty. I am 100% certain that there is no such thing as a bad person. Because when you speak to people who are doing things that other people might label as bad, like let's say domestic violence or something like that. Like I said, with the monsters, there's a positive intention behind all of it and there's fear behind all of it. And you can't work as a therapist with a client unless you can operate from a position of love. But you automatically do. As soon as you sit down and talk to somebody, regardless of what it says, you know, on their list of things they want to improve about themselves, you just lose the ability to judge people for that because you see through to the human beneath it. And I think that being able to really know that there is no such thing as a bad human and everyone is trying their hardest, it's just that we're making mistakes, is just an amazing gift, because A, it makes it much nicer to talk to people and much easier to move through problems, but also it means you have to send that back at yourself, so that when you have a bad day or you make some kind of mistake, you can know that you're operating from a position of being human and it's all right, you're not all evil.
Throwing it back then to the book, The Mind Monster Solution, that I mentioned right at the start, is that almost the next step really in your journey to helping people? Is that how it came about?
Yeah, I mean, I started out, I did some online courses and people were really, it was really fun to put the processes, the sort of creative therapeutic processes together into an online course, and people were getting big benefits from it for just a fraction of the price, you know, because therapy is expensive. It's really expensive. If you're going to be in therapy for a year or something, you're talking thousands of pounds. Or something like that. I'm not going to sit here and do the proper maths, but it's a lot, and depending on who you see. So I was excited to get these courses going. I was excited to see that people could actually get a benefit from something like that, and the next step was going to be a book. And actually the next step after that, which is one of the startups I'm working on at the moment, is a game. We are making an interactive fiction game, which is basically like a choose your own adventure novel, where people are the character in a story in this crazy sort of dystopian magical world, and they have to learn the psychological superpowers to battle evil, aka their monster. Not battle it, but to try and battle it and then learn how to effectively work with it instead. And so it's sort of the even more creative version of everything I've been talking about. So what, actually taking this whole metaphor idea to the max and putting them in a setting in this completely metaphorical ice world with this strange narrator talking to you and this strange monster hot on your heels. It's really fun. It's really, really fun.
Yeah, I'm, and likewise, same as what we talked about before in terms of your clients, it must be great to hear the feedback that you're getting as well. And I imagine there's plenty of stuff that you've learned in terms of the feedback from what you've produced as well.
Oh yeah, I mean the feedback, especially with the game, we've been testing at every single stage in order to get the feedback that helps us to develop it properly. And it's amazing to see and hear what people put into and get out of a game like this, because especially when you're working metaphorically, everyone's going to take what they need from it. And so very often people bring their problem to it and they get a meaning from it that we'd never even considered being in there. And they were like, the best bit about this was when you said XYZ. And we're like, we never said that. But they've just taken what they needed from this sort of metaphorical story. So that's amazing. And also to see, because the game is really creative, not just from our side, but from the player's side too. We're asking them, giving them an opportunity to create sort of imaginary spaces and write about them in as much detail or poetic detail as they might want to. And we've seen some of the stuff that people have written into those sections, and they're amazing. It's amazing to see what people come up with when given the opportunity to let loose with their creative minds. And it's obviously so beneficial in terms of their emotional health, but it's also just interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. To bring it back to sport then, and your kickboxing and boxing career, and I suppose it's almost, you almost feel naturally obliged to call it sort of a dark part in your life considering what's happened, but I know that's clearly not the case because there was a lot of success there, along with all the various things that you were going through mentally. And we've got, to name just a few, the ISKA full contact world champion in 2010, light continuous world champion in 2010 as well. That's named just two. I mean, how do you look back on your sporting career now? Or is it almost, despite all the dark side or dark parts of it, has it almost made you into the person that you are now regarding your therapy career?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, people often ask you that question of like, what would you go back and tell a 16 or 20 year old you? And I think, you know, the logical thing would be for me to go back and say, you know, you're good enough as you are. You don't need to prove that you're stronger than anyone. And if I'd done that, and if I'd actually been able to hear it, because of course I wouldn't have heard any of that. People were telling me that anyway, but I never listened. But if I'd actually heard that, maybe I would have avoided the burnout and my time in sport would have been very different. But I wouldn't go back and make that change because we have to go through this stuff in order to learn who we really are. And yes, it might have meant that I had a few years of illness, which were horrible. And yes, it might have meant that I didn't take the sporting career as far as maybe I would have done if I'd been properly healthy all the way through it. But I don't care. I'm much more interested in having gone through something that's brought me to a place where I can make this incredible game and sit and talk with people about their metaphorical problems and do everything I'm doing at the moment, because I know I'm in exactly the right place. If I hadn't have gone through that experience, who knows where I would be right now.
Is that almost something in itself, in that a lot of the time we always consider the advice that we were given when we were younger, but maybe does it actually help in some way to ignore that advice and find it out for yourself?
Well, you just can't take advice that you don't get. So most people learn, you know, we all do it in our 30s, really, don't we? We go through, for the majority of people, they're kind of a little bit oblivious through their angsty as teens, then into their 20s, think everything's fine, hit their 30s, then suddenly realise they've got these issues that they sort of crept up on them, they didn't know where they'd come from. Most people know what the problem is. It's not that they haven't been given the advice, they haven't been told what to do. Most people know that they should accept themselves and that they should have boundaries and that they should, you know, be healthy with their exercise routines and what they eat and not drink too much. Most people know this stuff. That doesn't mean they do it. So experience is the greatest teacher, really, isn't it? It's not a case of just ignoring the advice and learning it yourself. It's a case of having the advice delivered to you in the moment when it actually resonates and when you're ready to receive it, which is one of the brilliant things about working in therapy, is that people have come to the session ready to make a change. They're primed for it most of the time. So you don't need to fight through that kind of resistance in the same kind of way as you would do if you just plucked a random 16-year-old out of a crowd and tried to tell them to love themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm definitely looking forward to my 30th birthday now after that. I've got a lot of things that hit me then. give it some time. But I suppose there is a lot to say in that, and that this is something that's resonated quite a lot with guests we've had on before who've talked about various mental health things, is that you need to be in the position yourself where you are accepting of that advice and actually willing to not so much put the effort in, but actually make those extra strides and steps in your life to fix what you think is wrong.
Yeah, I'd say it is put the effort in. It always takes effort. Nobody can do it for you. So yeah, you have to be in a place where you're prepared to put the effort in, because if you don't, nothing's going to happen. A lot of the time, you know, that is the process of therapy for people. And it was for me at first, the first while I was in therapy, you know, a good few months, if not a year or so, where I was still just waiting for someone to come along with the magic wand, the magic process or the magic supplement or whatever that was going to just fix me without me having to do anything. Because we live in a quick fix world. We are sold products by advertising every day that promise to to just magically remedy some issue. And every single time we buy one, we're like, oh man, I thought this was going to make cooking so much easier, but actually it's really a real pain to clean up or whatever. I thought this moisturizer was going to make me look beautiful, and actually I still look like a haggard old 40-year-old woman. But we fall for it all the time because we want to believe that there's a quick fix out there. And that's the same with therapy. It's only when we suddenly, we have to finally admit to ourselves what we knew all along, which is, this is my, you know, mountain to climb. That's when we're going to make the changes.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of that kind of resonates, I suppose, in maybe the, it might change because of lockdown, to be honest. I've always wondered that, but it's almost like society became so impatient, and that's almost filtered into people's lives, and that when things do get tough, you do want that quick fix that you've been talking about. And we talk about how much effort it takes on your part to make those changes, and there is always a lot of effort. But I suppose, talking mainly from your perspective as well, and what you've seen in your experience, I mean, how does it almost take extra effort to keep pushing along when you have that, say, one step back after you've taken two steps forward? Because I imagine that's the point where a lot of people can't, not so much give up, but can really struggle with, when they don't feel like they are making that progress that they think they should be.
Yeah, definitely. I've got basically a whole big section on my book, in my book, on this sort of concept of victimhood. And I don't mean that in an objective way. I don't mean when somebody has been objectively victimized by someone or something. I just mean the state of mind we put ourselves in, which we all do, which is kind of just this, like, I can't, it's no good, nothing's going to change. The irony is that we do this in like every domestic argument. You'll see people battling for the place of victim. They want to be able to say, this is your fault, you did this to me, I was helpless against you. Like, we want to be able to say we're the victim, because it means that we're not at fault. And so as standard, we kind of go for that very often. But the reality of being in that place is it's the most disempowering experience. And when I was struggling with the chronic fatigue, I can see that I was putting myself into victim all the time by saying, you know, I didn't want, if people asked me how I was, I'd say, yeah, not too bad. As if I couldn't just say, yeah, I'm fine, thanks. Nice weather out. You know, everything had to be this kind of like, poor me. You know, it's really hard to be me. My body's not working. I'm really tired, but I can't sleep. And I was talking about it all the time. And I was telling it to myself too. Just, I can't change this. I got so livid with my body for not working properly. You know, for putting me through all this pain and meaning that I can't follow my dreams, you know, such a victim, poor me, poor me, poor me. And that mindset was basically the root of the entire problem. When I moved out of that and I stopped hating my body and my monster and all that stuff, stopped trying to fight against it and just accepted that I was human and responsible for myself, that's when I became actually strong. So before, I was trying to be strong in this muscly kind of beating people, superior, fighting off the world way. But the reality now, my definition of strength has changed entirely, because now I would say that that's it, being able to actually take responsibility for everything. That's real strength, and it moves you forward very, very quickly.
Yeah, and that redefining of the word strength, I think, is something quite key. And to throw it back to the current situation that we find ourselves in, because obviously the lockdown at the moment, not being able to see people, understandably is having a huge impact on people's health and mental health. And it's almost like that frustration that if you were in a bad place before, and that you can't make those improvements now because we're all shut inside our homes at the moment, is that something you think is a particularly key message to hammer home at this point in time?
Yeah, I mean, people are responding to lockdown in sort of one of two very basic ways. They're either thriving and loving the fact that they don't have to feel obliged to leave the house and go out for that drinks that they didn't want to go to, etc. Or they are allowing themselves to feel like a victim of it, and allowing themselves to literally feel like a prisoner. And it's a choice. It's a choice how we respond to it. The fact of the matter is, we can't do anything about it. Unless we want to break the rules. So if we don't want to break the rules, then what we have to do is find a way to be able to accept it and move through it. making the most of it. I mean, this sounds like such a sort of lame argument, just make the most of it, but it isn't. Like, when you actually take on that perspective, you find that there are so many things that you had never known you were missing out on because you were just refusing to be happy because you wanted to be sort of wallowing in misery instead, because that's what we're like when we're in the victim place. Like, I need to prove to everybody, including myself, that my life is like, that doesn't get you anywhere. Well, it does, it gets you into a really feeling line.
And one of the to throw it onto that point, really, and one of the key pieces of advice that I kind of dug out for this period was John McAvoy, triathlete, who of course was in prison for several years for armed robbery and things like that. But I think it was on the Olympic Channel podcast, and he basically said how you can use this time to essentially, it's like your life is on pause, and how often do we get the opportunity to just pause your life and actually take stock of everything you've got and you want. And from your advice, or any advice you could give, would it be centered around that sort of viewpoint as well?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would use the word life being paused, because for many people it doesn't feel that way. But any kind of challenge is an opportunity, and in the sort of the psychology side of it, that's especially true. And you know, it's really interesting, when we went into lockdown, most of my therapy clients who were anxious were surprisingly calm. So they were all like, one of them said, I think maybe I've been in training for this my whole life. So the people who aren't struggling with anxiety are getting anxious suddenly because there's this pandemic and they might get ill and all this stuff. People who are really anxious were suddenly like, I feel fine. And I think really what that was about is that now they could point to something and say, that's the big bad thing here. So you know, I'm normal to be afraid of it. And that actually reduced their anxiety. But other people are finding their anxiety is going through the roof, sort of out of nowhere. And one of the things that's happening a hell of a lot is people's monsters, old monsters that they thought they dealt with, are resurfacing. So people who decades ago had a drinking problem, now they're in lockdown and they're wondering why all of a sudden they're thinking of drinking again. People, again, comfort eating, people with comfort eating problems all over the world right now are struggling with that majorly, because everything's been chucked up in the air, because everything's uncertain. We reach for our coping mechanisms, and also because everything's so the same, we reach for our coping mechanisms, and so our monsters are sort of shouting louder than normal. And so the opportunity within this challenge is to use this time not to just go down the comfort route of, you know, binging on Netflix or food or whatever, or getting drunk every night, but instead to say, I can actually use the discomfort or all of this to meet my monster face to face, to do that awareness building work that puts me in a place where I can start to change that habit and change the way I feel about myself, rather than feeling like a victim of it. Does that make sense? I kind of went in a big circle
there. No, that absolutely does make sense. I'm pretty sure a lot of people can relate to that as well, considering what's going on at the moment. And to throw it open to sort of more, not so much lockdown advice, but things that can help you through lockdown. And since we're a sports podcast and all, it's something I'm quite keen to highlight when we have our guests on, is just how important activity and sporting activity can be during this time. And you've obviously got your boxing to go back and consider and relate to. But I mean, it throws it open really to a wider question as to how important do you think sport is to people and people's well-being?
Oh my God. I mean, it's just the body and mind are not separate things. If your body is unwell, your mind will be unwell. If your mind is unwell, your body will be unwell. On some level, those two things happen like that. So it's essential that we're moving at the moment. I say that knowing full well that I'm not moving enough. I've been so busy. I've had a number of days in the last few weeks where I've not really moved from my chair, apart from way too late moving to the sofa. And that's my 10 steps for the day, you know. But yes, in theory, you know, we should be making the effort to make sure we're moving all the time and getting outside, because it's vital. My partner is an ex-Olympic champion rower, and I managed to convince him to bring one of the rowing machines home from the gym at the beginning of lockdown, because I suddenly realized everyone at that point was still saying, it'll probably be a couple of weeks then it'll be done. And I was like, guys, I don't think so. This is going to go on for some time. And I found myself staring down the barrel of months and months and months of not really being able to do any training at all, because I can't run because of a knee problem. So I was like, whoa, what am I going to do? So I got the rowing machine at home, and I've been loving having the rowing machine at home. I'm not going to let them take it back. It's sort of taking up one of our hallways. But being able to actually, even on very busy days, to get a 15-minute or 20-minute row in is the change in my mood is enormous.
That's the thing. It makes all the difference, doesn't it? Because, I mean, the same thing, and you find yourself sitting on the same chair, staring at the same screen from, say, 7 o'clock in the morning right through until 5, 6 in the evening. And even just to get those 10 minutes outside, if it's for a walk or whatever it might be, does seem to make the world of difference. And I like to think that a lot of people are realizing that for themselves now. I haven't seen as many people out running as I do now compared to before lockdown. So I think
people feel like it's a privilege now.
Exactly.
That's what's nice about it. They feel like it's a privilege, so they're taking the opportunity more. I hope it sticks.
Likewise. Similarly, I hope it sticks. To quickly touch on before I wrap up the episode, and obviously women in sport and trying to give women's sport equal coverage where possible is a big thing for us as a show, as I'm sure is no surprise to regular listeners and people who just have a quick scout through our website. But from your perspective, and to throw open a couple of newsworthy topics at the moment, when you hear about the idea or notion of women's leagues, whether it's football leagues or anything like that, losing out on finances because of the current situation, obviously very depressing to hear. But how important is it, do you think, that we do not lose focus on women's sport through this period? Something obviously I know Stacey Copeland, who introduced the two of us, is very passionate about and very big on herself.
Yeah, I mean, this is equal rights in general, but in particular gender, because of course that's the one I've struggled with personally the most, is something I'm really, really passionate about. And I just find it so fundamentally unfair that people can still think they can justify it. Like, they still think they can say that men should be getting paid more because they're better or because they're stronger or faster or something. Like, men should get more for running the 100 meters because they can do it faster, as if I just think it's vital we don't lose focus. I mean, this is a battle that's been fought for you know, very, very long time. This is not just a lockdown issue. And we are making progress, but there is so far to go. So, we can't lose focus. We can't lose focus. Lockdown doesn't change a thing about it. I'm sorry, I don't have a more eloquent answer than just yes, I agree. But yeah, I mean, you know what, actually, there is a slightly more interesting answer. The fight I talked about earlier on, the 2013 one, Stacey was fighting at that too. She was in the weight category above me then. And we were in, at that point, the women's and men's boxing championships were at different venues. The men were at Echo Arena with this big event and, you know, like smoke machines and music to walk out to and proper camera, proper coverage on TV and stuff. And where were we? We were in like a shed in Essex with no coverage, just, you know, one dude walking around with a camera that you then had to pay for the photographs from afterwards if you wanted them. And we got, you know, the men were getting these big belts and we were getting these crappy little medals. And that was the last year it was like that. I didn't compete at the one after that because I'd then retired. But the next year, women were at the Echo Arena with men, and the uproar in the boxing community was massive. Men were like, what's happening? I don't like it. You know, at the time, people were still only just getting comfortable with the idea of women boxing in the Olympics. You know, Amir Khan and everyone coming out before the Olympics saying that they didn't think it was a good idea and they just didn't think women should be boxing, and then eating their words afterwards when the women's competition was, you know, arguably in some ways better than the men's at the 2012, certainly the lower weight categories. So yeah, I've seen it from that side, and I just find it a complete affront to my very idea of fairness, and I can't really believe it's still happening, but it is, so we mustn't stop fighting.
Yeah, and if anyone wanted a visual interpretation of the inequality, I think you've just given it right there, and it is still baffling. On so many occasions, we still see it, and like you say, there is so much work that still needs to be done on that front. And to be honest, I'm not sure what was worse, being in a shed or being in Essex. But I live in Essex, so I'm allowed to.
I like Essex. It wasn't that the shed was.
But like you say, back to the serious point, it does sum up how far we have to go. And I don't know if there's anything, obviously this is a very big question, but if there's anything you think immediately in the short term we should be focusing on and pushing, whether it's in boxing specifically or across the board.
Okay, one little thing that I really would love everyone to stop doing. Two things, actually. One, stop calling women girls. People do this in sport all the time. And the girls, you know, the girls playing tennis, the girls doing this. They're not girls. That's two 25 or 30-year-old women. They're women, not girls. So let's not infantilize people. So that's one thing. And the other is to stop referring to the women's divisions of sport as women's such and such. So you've got the tennis and then the women's tennis. You've got the football and then the women's football. What? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Yes, call it, if you need to differentiate, call it men's football and women's football in the same sentence. But we need to stop always talking about the women's version of a sport as if it's like this secondary add-on. So I've been asked a number of times to teach women's boxing sessions, and most of the time I've said absolutely not. And the reason I don't want to is because I don't want to be on a website where you've got boxing class, women's boxing class, which is like, what happens at that one? We turn up and put on pink gloves and tickle each other or something. So yeah, that's what I would say. Stop calling women's girls and women girls, and stop speaking about women's divisions as if they're a subset of the sport.
We can all get behind, and something a lot of people can take on board. And when you still read some of the comments that float around on social media, it is, well, remains deeply frustrating that a lot of people don't seem to still get that message, really. But yeah, bit by bit, we hope things will improve. My final question then, before I wrap up this particular interview, again, we've talked a lot about various different topics, and I'm pretty certain that a lot of people will find this incredibly beneficial to their own health and what they're going through at the moment as well. But basically, this is a chance to you to really plug your sport, plug your book, and any of that last bit of advice really you would like to give to people before we wrap up this particular episode, and how they can follow a similar journey really to yourself and try and tame that monster, as it were.
Befriend it. You know, the one little thing on the monster, the way my book ends is you stop calling it a monster and calling it a mentor instead, because I realized only halfway through writing the book that the word monster is an anagram of the word mentors. And the whole point of this is, when you actually listen to your problems as a teaching point rather than try to fight them off as a demon, then you move forward. So if anybody wants to learn how to turn their monster into a mentor, then of course they can buy my book, which is The Mind Monster Solution. And if they just want to follow me on social media and stay in touch, then Instagram is probably the best one, which is my handle is @hazel.gale, that's G-A-L-E, .therapy. Although I'm a bit quiet on social at the moment because I'm so busy. I also have a Facebook group, which is equally quiet, and I feel a bit guilty about that, but I haven't been able to do much about it. And the game isn't out yet. We're just about to do our first bit of testing. It's going to be out soon, and it's going to be called Betwixt, I think. That's what we're going with the name at the moment, and actually I'm really excited about it. It used to be called Mind Monsters, and if anyone wants to look at the website for that, it's at mindmonsters.co.uk. But we're not going to call it Mind Monsters now, we're going to call it Betwixt. And that should be out quite soon, and I'm really excited about that. Really, really excited. I think we're going to be releasing the first few sort of chapters of it for free. So if anyone wants to follow me on social, they'll certainly find out when that comes out. And if anyone wants to play a strange metaphorical game to improve their mental health, then that's the place to be.
Absolutely. And we ourselves as a show can definitely get behind that, and we can, or we will rather, put links to your Instagram and to your website in the show notes as well, so people can just scroll through the episode and follow through there. With that brings an end to this particular feature interview on the podcast. first and foremost, thank you so much, Hazel, for coming on and giving us a really insightful look into, I suppose, the concept of the mind monster and befriending it. It's quite interesting to be able to almost put a persona on something that quite a lot of people will have to face at some point in their lives. And obviously talking about your own experiences, which I've always said is a massive thing to put out there in public, regardless of who it's coming from. And I don't think it ever changes, but I do think it helps people immensely when you have that person to connect with, really, and to relate to when they've shared their experiences. And likewise, I'm pretty sure the cognitive hypnotherapy side of things is something that people will get to look at further down the line as well. Yeah. So that, ultimately, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all of that. And I really hope lockdown continues to treat you well, and maybe one day we will return to some sort of normal.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been great.
A huge thank you to Hazel for joining us on the show, and I really hope everyone found that conversation to be particularly eye-opening, because I certainly did. And another huge thank you goes to Stacey Copeland, who put us in contact in the first place. As mentioned, midway through this podcast, we have a very important event coming up on July 10th with the Mintridge Foundation, the 28 Not Out live panel featuring England rugby international Dan Cole. And that, of course, is all in memory of Max Hunter, who died in August 2019. We will be doing the live panel over Zoom, and full details can be found in the Eventbrite link in the show notes of this podcast. Similarly, we should also be sharing the completed quarterfinal legs of the Mintridge Mastermind tournament we're running, so keep an eye on social media for that. That is it from us on this edition of the podcast. Please follow us on social media and share the word. All of our handles are SportsBuildPod. Stay safe, everyone, and we will see you very soon.